3rd, we're celebrating 5 birthdays here on IRIS. Francis Rowland of Indianola, Madeline Halter of Iowa City, Mary Vander Ecken of Melcher, Carolyn Lee of Council Bluffs, and Cliff Kramer of Solon. So a very happy birthday to Francis, Madeline, Mary, Carolyn, and Cliff, and hope it's a terrific day for all of you. Celebrities celebrating this birthdays on April 23rd include actor Lee Majors. He'll be 85 years old. Actor Blair Brown, 78. Actor Joyce DeWitt, 75 years old. Director Michael Moore will be 70. Actor Judy Davis will be 69. Actor TV host Valerie Bertinelli is 64. Actor Craig Sheffer is 64. Comedian actor George Lopez is 63. Actor John Hannah is 62. Actor Scott Bairstow is 54. Actor-writer John Lutz is 51. Wrestler-actor John Cena is 47. Political commentator and comedian John Oliver is 47. Actor Cal Penn is 47. Actor Jamie King, 45. Singer Teo Cruz is 44. Jesse Lee Sofer, actor, is 40. Actor Dev Patel is 34. And model Gigi Hadid is 29. So there's your celebrity birthdays for today. You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television and Iowa PBS and you're not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. Now, here's Deanna with today's obituaries.
Thank you, Pat. Robert Dillard Goodpasture of Rockwell, Texas, age 96, passed away on April 13th. He was born on February 19th, 1928, a beloved member of the community. He will be dearly missed. Carl Ray Kirschbaum of Ankeny, aged 75, passed away on April 20th. He was born in Des Moines and is survived by Clover, his wife of 55 years. One sister, 4 children, has a lifelong teamster in the trucking industry, and a celebration of life will be held at a later date. Margaret Joanne Utzler of Carlisle, with a heart filled with utmost respect and adoration, we celebrate the extraordinary life of Margaret Joanne Utzler, known lovingly as Joanne, who passed away peacefully on April 19th. Born in Atlantic on July 14th, 1931, she spent her fruitful life of 92 years nurturing, inspiring, and spreading joy among her community in Carlisle. She was married on June 3rd, 1950, and she dedicated her life to the service of children in her community. Over a span of 16 years, she maneuvered the school bus with unwavering dedication, ensuring the safety transportation of her young passengers. More than 25 years following her retirement, she continued to touch lives by offering in-home daycare services. In the words of Martin Luther King, the time is always right to do what is right. And for her, she was endlessly caring for and nurturing the children in her community. Survived by her loving daughter, Kim, and Margaret, she leaves behind a legacy of love, resilience, and service. Her life was a testament to the power of empathy and the strength of community service. And a visitation will be held Thursday, April 25th at 5 o'clock at Peterson Funeral Home on School Street in Carlisle. Funeral services will be held at the same venue on Friday, April 26th at 10 o'clock in the morning, followed by interment on Saturday, the 27th at the Carlisle Cemetery. In words of Mahatma Gandhi, live as if you were to die tomorrow, learn as if you were to live forever. Melinda Amanda Aswegan of Amanda, age 93, passed away peacefully on April 18th. Melinda was born on January 29th, 1931 in Bremer County, to August and Maria Brandt. She was united in marriage to Erwin John Aswegan on September 26, 1953. Together they raised their family in Ankeny. She was a charter member of St. Paul Lutheran Church, survived by her children Michael of Las Cruces, New Mexico, Mary of Ankeny, married to Craig Catron, and James, married to Robbie of Alleman, and Jackie, married to Tom Horton of Woodbine in Georgia. Grandchildren, great-grandchildren, a brother and three sisters. She was preceded in death by her husband, Irwin. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. on Thursday, April 25th at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Ankeny. Visitation will be at 10 o'clock in the morning until the service on Thursday. Interment will be at a later date at Rest Haven Cemetery in West Des Moines. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be directed to St. Paul Lutheran Church. Pat.
Thank you, Deanna. Continuing now with stories from the front page of Des Moines Register. Opening statements start in the Trump trial. This is a story from USA Today and Dateline New York. After 4 days of jury selection, former President Donald Trump's New York hush money trial kicked off for real Monday with opening statements. The case centers on allegations that Trump falsified business records to cover up hush money payment from his former lawyer Michael Cohen to porn star Stormy Daniels. According to prosecutors, Trump authorized the payment in order to keep Daniels from hurting his 2016 presidential campaigns by going public with her story that the pair had sex. Trump denies Daniels' claim and has pleaded not guilty. The trial is not being televised as per New York court rules, and Mershon asked the media not to report identifying details of jurors. He has not sequestered the jury. Judge Mershon also gave jurors extensive instructions on the trial and their role within it. He told them not to be influenced by stereotypes or implicit biases. He said they are not permitted to speak with others about the case because only they are authorized to decide. And then the statements began. This case is about a criminal conspiracy and a cover-up, said prosecutor Matthew Colangelo. Trump orchestrated a criminal scheme to interfere with the 2016 presidential election and covered it up by lying in his New York business records over and over and over again. He described a juror as a meeting among Trump, Cohen, and a tabloid publisher, David Pecker. The men agreed to a three-pronged conspiracy to interfere with the 2016 presidential election, Colangelo said. Pecker would be the campaign's eyes and ears, reporting potentially harmful information to Cohen, who would work to keep it quiet. Colangelo described this as, the, quote, the core, unquote, of the conspiracy. Pecker would publish flattering stories about Trump, and Pecker would use his publications to attack Trump's political opponents. Part of the scheme, a catch-and-kill effort to secure the story of former Playboy model Karen McDougal, who said she had an affair with Trump, a claim Trump denies. Pecker agreed to have his company pay McDougal $150,000 to keep her quiet by buying exclusive rights to her story, but then not publishing it. Jurors will hear Trump in his own voice on tape saying, "So what do we got to pay for the $150,000?" the prosecutor said. The core reason for the payment was to keep the story from hurting Trump's campaign, Colangelo claimed. Then came the effort to quiet Daniels. Cohen sent $130,000 payment to Daniels' lawyer to kill the story before the 2016 election, Colangelo said. Cohen made that payment at Donald Trump's direction and for his benefit, Colangelo said, claiming it was election fraud, pure and simple. Cohen's testimony in the trial, Colangelo said, will be backed up by a paper trail that includes phone logs and business documents and by Donald Trump's own words on tape, in social media posts, in his own books, and in video of his own speeches. Simply put, Colangelo concluded, Trump is guilty of 34 counts of falsifying business record. The defense, however, hits back. Trump defense lawyer Todd Blanche said to begin his opening statement, President Trump is innocent. Blanche said his team will refer to Trump as President Trump throughout the trial out of respect for the office he held. Contradicting prosecutors, Blanche denied that Trump was reimbursing Cohen for the Daniels hush money. Blanche said Cohen was Trump's personal attorney. Blanche told the jurors, moreover, there's nothing wrong with trying to influence an election. It's called democracy. He added that prosecutors have put a sinister spin on this, as if it's a crime, but jurors will learn it's not. Then Blanche amped up the drama. Daniels' testimony, while salacious, does not matter, he said. Taking his time, he emphasized that Trump denies the actor's claim. paying Daniels for her agreement to not publicly spread false claims about Trump isn't illegal, Blanche told the jurors. As for Cohen, he has a goal, an obsession with getting Trump, and you're going to hear that, the defense attorney added. He has lied multiple times under oath, Blanche began. Prosecutors objected, and Mershan sustained it. Blanche then told jurors that they will learn Cohen has pleaded guilty to lying under oath. Blanche said, use your common sense. We're New Yorkers. In conclusion, Blanche reminded jurors they promised to put aside any views they have about Trump and decide the case based on the evidence presented in the trial. If they do that, there will be a very swift, not guilty verdict for Trump, he claimed. After a break, Pecker briefly took the stand for the remainder of the short day. Proceedings ended at 12:30 p.m. due to an alternate juror's emergency dental appointment. Pecker is scheduled to appear again Tuesday after Mershon hears arguments about whether Trump has violated a gag order. It wasn't Trump's only legal proceeding of the day. New York Judge Arthur Eniguan approved a new agreement Monday between Trump's lawyers and State Attorney General Letitia James to reinforce the $175 million bond Trump posted to appeal a $454 million judgment in a civil fraud trial for inflating the value of his real estate empire. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. All right, Terry Anderson, a U.S. journalist, who was held captive by Islamist militants for almost 7 years in Lebanon and came to symbolize the plight of Western hostages during the country's 1975 to 1990 civil war, died on Sunday at age 76, his former employer, the Associated Press, said. This article is by Alastair Bell. Anderson was a journalism graduate of Iowa State University. Kept in barely lit cells by mostly Shiite Muslim groups in what was known as the hostage crisis, and chained by his hands and feet and blindfolded much of the time, the former Marine later recalled that he almost went insane and that only his Roman Catholic faith prevented him from taking his life before he was freed in December of 1991. Anderson's ordeal began in Beirut on the morning of March 16, 1985, after he played a round of tennis. A green Mercedes sedan with curtains over the rear window pulled up, and three gunmen jumped out and dragged Anderson, still dressed in his shorts, into the car. The pro-Iran Islamic Jihad group claimed responsibility for the kidnapping, saying it was part of a continuing operations against Americans. The abductors demanded freedom for Shiite Muslims jailed in Kuwait for bomb attacks against the U.S. and French embassies there. It was the start of a nightmare for Anderson that would last 6 years and 9 months, during which he was stuck in cells under the rubble-strewn streets of Beirut and elsewhere, often badly fed and sleeping on a thin, dirty mattress on a concrete floor. During captivity, both his father and brother would die of cancer, and he would not see his daughter, born 3 months after he was seized, until she was 6 years old. What kept me going? He asked aloud shortly after his release. My companions. I was lucky to have people with me most of the time. My faith, stubbornness. You do what you have to do. You wake up every day, summon up the energy from somewhere. You think you haven't got it, and you get through the day, and you do it. Day after day after day. Other hostages described Anderson as tough and active in captivity, learning French and Arabic, and exercising regularly. However, they also told of him banging his head against the wall until he bled, in frustration at beatings, isolation, false hopes, and the feeling of being neglected by the outside world. Anderson said in a videotape released by his captors in December of 87, he said, there is a limit of how long we can last, and some of us are approaching the limit very badly. Marcel Fontaine, a French diplomat who was released in May of 1988 after 3 years of captivity, recalled the time cellmate Anderson thought freedom was near because he was allowed to see the sun and eat a hamburger. In April 1987, Anderson was given a suit of clothes that his captors had made for him. He wore it every day, said Fontaine. A week later, however, Anderson's captors took the suit back, leaving him in despair and certain that he was forgotten. Scores of journalist groups, governments, and individuals over the years called for Anderson's release, and his October 27th birthday became an unofficial U.S. Memorial Day for hostages. Anderson said he considered killing himself several times, but rejected it. He relied heavily on his faith, which he said he had renewed 6 months before being kidnapped. "I must have read the Bible 50 times from the start to finish," he said. "It was an enormous help to me." His sister, Peggy Say, who died in 2015, was his fiercest advocate during captivity. She worked tirelessly for her brother's freedom. She visited Arab and European capitals, lobbied the Pope, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and every U.S. official and politician available. Each year, on the anniversary of Anderson's kidnapping, Iowa State University held a ceremony in which Carol Honor Richard von Grebau struck a toll for each month Anderson had been in captivity, according to Register archives. On the sixth anniversary in March 1991, the carillon sounded 72 times. At the ceremony, legendary journalism professor Jack Shelley recalled Anderson from his days on campus in Ames. Shelley, who taught Anderson in several classes and served as his academic advisor, said Anderson was mature and a very good student. Under pressure from the media and the U.S. hostages' families, the Reagan administration negotiated a secret and illegal deal in the mid-1980s to facilitate arms sales to Iran in return for the release of American hostages. But the deal, known as the Iran-Contra affair, failed to gain freedom for any of the hostages. Longtime KCCI-TV anchor Kevin Cooney covered the release of U.S. hostages from Lebanon, which included Anderson, as well as Thomas Sutherland, who earned his master's degree and doctorate in animal science at Iowa State. During a news conference, Anderson recognized Cooney from his days at Iowa State and from working at KCCI and hugged him on camera, the Register reported. Born October 27, 1947, in Lorain, Ohio, Anderson grew up in Batavia, New York. He graduated from Iowa State and spent 6 years in the Marine Corps, mostly as a journalist. He worked for the AP in Detroit, Louisville, New York, Tokyo, Johannesburg, and then Beirut, where he first went to cover the Israeli invasion in 1982. In that war-torn city, he fell in love with a Lebanese woman, Madeline Bassel, who was his first fiancée and pregnant with their daughter when he was snatched. Anderson and fellow hostages developed a system of communication by tapping on walls between their cells. Always a journalist, Anderson passed on news of the outside world that he had picked up during captivity to Church of England envoy Terry Waite, being held hostages in an adjacent room in September of 1990 after years of solitary confinement. In his book called Den of Lions, published in 1993, Anderson said, "Then the world news, the Berlin Wall's falling, communism's demise in Eastern Europe, free elections in the Soviet Union, work toward multiracial government in South Africa, all of the incredible things that have happened since he was taken nearly 3 years ago." Anderson wrote in his 1993 book, Den of Lions, "He thought I was crazy." After his release, Anderson taught journalism at Columbia University in New York, Ohio University, University of Kentucky, and the University of Florida until he retired in 2015. Among businesses he invested in were a horse ranch in Ohio and a restaurant. He unsuccessfully ran for the Ohio State Senate as a Democrat in 2004 and sued Iran in federal court for his abduction, winning a multi-million dollar settlement in 2002. Pat, back to you.
Thank you, Deanna. We'll now turn to our 50 states. This is kind of a capsule about the lead story in each of the 50 states in America. And the highlight this day is South Carolina. And it's a statue unveiling Friday on the first three black students to enroll in the University of South Carolina post-Reconstruction: Robert G. Anderson, Henry Monteith Treadwell, and James Solomon Jr. are forever enshrined in USC's high honor quad known as the Horseshoe, with a 12-foot bronze statue. It marks the 60th anniversary of the trio's enrollment. The ceremony took place at the McKissick Museum, the site of the Osborne Administration Building, where Anderson, Treadwell, and Solomon had a photo taken of their historic first steps as university students back in 1963. Elsewhere, and I think, Deanna, I'm going to start at the the end of the alphabet with Wyoming, so we see if we can get some of those states that sometimes we don't get to because of time. So in Cheyenne, Wyoming, Governor Mark Gordon has wielded his veto power several times this year by rejecting more than 20 sections and line items in the 2024 budget. Recently, he denied various amendments by Secretary of State Chuck Gray regarding Wyoming's election procedures. The proposed changes would have required Wyoming voters to prove the residency if not already shown on their identification. From our neighbor to the north, Wisconsin, George Hinton, the beleaguered chief executive officer of the Social Development Commission in Milwaukee, resigned under pressure. His resignation comes after a series of missteps, including the misallocation of more than $100,000 in taxpayer funds, resulting in the closure of the weatherization program and layoffs of 28 employees and the termination of the finance director. In Morgantown, West Virginia, the state's first ever beer festival was held at Milan Park on Saturday. In Washington State and Olympia, on the campaign trail, gubernatorial candidates are laying out their ferry plans to fix the system. The Washington State Ferry's aging fleet is plagued with disrepair as only 8 of the 21 vessels in its fleet are considered to be in a state of good repair. Richmond, Virginia, 4 reproductive health care bills were sent back to Governor Glenn Youngkin's desk for his signature or veto following the General Assembly reconvened session when lawmakers met to consider the governor's action on legislation passed during the regular 2024 session. Plainfield, Vermont, Goddard College will close its doors at the end of the semester, according to an announcement this month by the school's Board of Trustees. The decision was based on finances and was unavoidable, according to a news release. In Logan, Utah, NBA Youngboy has been arrested in Utah amid house arrest in a federal case. Inmate records show the 24-year-old rapper born Kentrell Golden was arrested in Cache County last week on 6 charges, including unlawful activity, procuring or attempting to procure drugs, identity fraud, forgery, possession of controlled substances, and possession of a dangerous weapon by a restricted person. In Austin, Texas, crime in that city is down through the first part of 2024 to levels lower than the same period of any year since 2020. Austin's crimes against persons and property are down 8 and 14% respectively, compared with the same period each year since 2020. However, crimes against society are up compared with last year, although not at the highest level in the past 4 years. In Nashville, earlier this year, Tennessee Governor Bill Lee proposed $3 million for a maternal health pilot program aimed at addressing a pressing need to improve health outcomes for expectant mothers. Now the General Assembly will redirect that grant money to crisis pregnancy centers. Republican-lauded anti-abortion organizations that are unregulated by state health standards and may not offer comprehensive health services. In Pierre in South Dakota, the head of the South Dakota Department of Transportation dismissed the possibility of passenger rail in the state during a meeting of the Railroad Authority Board last week. In Providence, Rhode Island, children contending with life-threatening illnesses receive the playhouses of their dreams through a program coordinated by students in the Project Management Club at Bryant University. Project Playhouse taps into community partnerships with area vocational high schools, local and national businesses, and the Tomorrow Fund. The houses are delivered to the kids' homes. In Erie, Pennsylvania, a man struck by a westbound freight train on Thursday has died of his injuries. And in Beaverton, Oregon, Nike plans to lay off 740 employees at its global headquarters in Oregon before June 28th, the company has told state officials. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. That was very thoughtful of you to start at the end. We have never done that before. Del City, Oklahoma. A Del City police officer will not be charged for shooting a man in the chest last August after a football game at Choctaw High School ended in chaos. Out of Cincinnati, Ohio, Every year, Ohio students take standardized tests that are analyzed by districts and the state alike to assess student progress. Accuracy is key in order to plan for schools' futures and meet students' needs. Now, some school districts say the Ohio Department of Education and Workforce is refusing to correct several data errors on recent school report cards. Because education data relies on previous reporting to show progress, districts say these mistakes will have a lasting impact. From Grand Forks, North Dakota, the University of North Dakota has received a $6.5 million donation from Sanford Health for endowments and campus upgrades, said the Grand Forks Herald. Out of Asheville, North Carolina, state officials are investigating after a group of people were captured on video yanking black bear cubs from a tree to take a selfie. It is illegal to disturb a bear den in North Carolina under state law. From Albany, New York, the New York region had a record-breaking start as the warming climate helped the parasitic pests emerge early this spring. Emergency rooms in the Northeast last month reported the highest tally of tick bite patients for a March in recent years, reinforcing concerns that tick-borne illnesses, including Lyme disease, will keep rising amid booming deer populations and milder winters. From Carlsbad, New Mexico, the city is mulling options to replace the North Mesa Senior Center, the interim city administrator said. From Atlantic City, New Jersey, last month, Atlantic City casinos collected over $468 million from gamblers. That marks the third month of steady gaming revenue for the city's nine gambling halls this calendar year. Out of Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Lauren Faulkner turned himself in to city police on an arrest warrant 14 months after a spree of hateful vandalism downtown. From Carson City, Nevada, the Nevada Supreme Court reversed a lower court decision that had blocked an abortion rights initiative from being on the 2024 ballot. Their ruling turns out to be moot, though. As a backup measure in case the court decided the other way, the group behind the initiative got approval earlier this year for a second abortion rights initiative that is less broad in scope. Both initiatives would strengthen abortion protections in Nevada's constitution. Out of Lincoln, Nebraska, Governor Jim Pillen signed a law that would remove members of the State Board of Parole from their jobs if they miss more than 12 full days of parole hearings in a calendar year, the Flatwood Free Press reported. Out of Helena, Montana, Montana is number one in the nation for drunken driving fatalities, according to a new ranking by Forbes, the Daily Montanan reported. Out of Columbia, Missouri, a project to widen Interstate 70 to six lanes is expected to start this summer on the Columbia to Kingdom City section. Ahead of this, the Missouri Department of Transportation is seeking public input on basic design plans, traffic control plans, scheduled and anticipated construction impacts of the project. And I will just jump to one last one from Nevada, Iowa. Iowa farmers recently told a federal trade leader that the agency should block the $3.6 billion sale of the Iowa Fertilizer Company to Koch Industries, saying it will further consolidate the industry and drive prices higher. Pat.
Thank you, Deanna. And for the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Deanna Snyder and Pat Steele, and it's been our pleasure to read for you. Now we will take a short break to allow our next readers, Dale and Doug, to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Dale Finnegan and Doug Kretzinger. We will continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. And now here's Doug with our next article.
Don't dismiss review of gender-affirming care. This article, Opinion, is written by Ingrid Jacques. One of the most contentious battles of our time is over what access transgender young people and their families should have to medical intervention. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court jumped into the fray by allowing Idaho to start enforcing its ban on what has become known by LGBTQ plus proponents as gender-affirming care for minors. The country is nearly split between Republican-led states that have acted to restrict puberty-blocking drugs, hormone treatments, and surgeries, and Democratic-led ones that want few, if any, limits. The name-calling on both sides of the issue hasn't helped. Conservatives wary of intrusive treatments are framed as not caring about transgender kids and making them feel unsafe. Liberals are accused of mutilating and indoctrinating children. Maybe the right course of action lies somewhere in between these extremes. With more children experiencing gender dysphoria than ever before, some humility is demanded. There's much that we simply don't know about the long-term implications of giving minors these drugs and surgeries that can permanently change the trajectory of their lives. That's one of the findings of the widely accepted, rather widely anticipated, CAS review released this month. The nearly 400-page report represents a years-long review by Dr. Hilary Cass, a pediatrician, of existing research as well as interviews with young people, families, and clinicians. The review was commissioned by England's National Health Service, which has already acted on some of Cass's interim recommendations. The NHS has said that puberty-blocking drugs will be available only for minors who are in a clinical trial. This follows a trend of other northern European countries hitting pause on such treatments. Cass's report is written in a clear and compassionate manner, and her findings deserve careful consideration in the United States, too. Cass's conclusions point to a need to slow down on drug treatments and that evidence supporting related gender care is remarkably weak. While Cass found that children deserve better, more comprehensive care related to their gender dysphoria, the report cautions strongly against the use of puberty blockers and hormones. Some of the key findings from the pediatrician's report. There is no simple explanation for the increase in the numbers of predominantly young people and young adults who have a trans or gender diverse identity, but there is broad agreement that it is a result of a complex interplay between biological, psychological, and social factors. And number two, this is in quotes, the strengths and weaknesses of the evidence base on the care of children and young people are often misrepresented and overstated, both in scientific publications and social debate. And another quote, the rationale for early puberty suppression remains unclear, with weak evidence regarding the impact on gender dysphoria, mental or psychosocial health, the effect on cognitive and psychosexual development remains unknown. And yet another quote, the use of hormones in those under the age of 18 also presents many unknowns, despite their long-standing use in the adult transgender population. And, quote, clinicians are unable to determine with any certainty which children and young people will go on to have an enduring trans identity. And, quote, for most young people, a medical pathway will not be the best way to manage their gender-related distress, end quotes. I was told there is one cure. These last two findings track with a growing number of young people who are telling their stories of distransitioning and who regret that they weren't offered more comprehensive help before hormones or surgery. Some professionals in the medical field are speaking out, too. Grace Powell, for instance, had believed she was a transgender as a teen and had a double mastectomy and took cross-sex hormones before college. Powell, now in her 20s, early 20s, has detransitioned. She told New York Times columnist Pamela Paul, "I wish there had been more, quote, I wish there had been more open conversations. But I was told there is one cure and one thing to do if this is your problem, and this will help you," end quote. Others have similar stories. When dealing with children, the traditional medical pledge to do no harm carries extra weight. Young people and their families deserve the best and most reliable information before making any big decisions. Cass's report raises many red flags about how little is known about the long-term consequences of gender-affirming medical treatment in children. She urges extreme caution multiple times throughout her review. Transgender activists, as if the science on this complicated issue is settled. As Cass shows us, that's far from the truth.
The second opinion today is written by Rex Hupke, and the title is "Trump Taxing GOP Hopefuls is on Brand for Party Takeover." I'd like to congratulate Donald Trump on the speed with which he's turned the Republican Party into something resembling an extortion racket. Aside from sinking his fangs into the Republican National Committee like a hungry bat on a plump Berkshire hog, the man spending his days in a Manhattan courtroom under criminal indictment is now looking to bleed cash out of down-ballot GOP campaigns. In an April 15th letter, Trump's re-election campaign notified all Republican candidates that if they use the former president's name, image, or likeness on any campaign advertisements, they need to deliver at least 5% of the money they raise back to the aforementioned criminal defendant. You know, a little kickback for the boss man. Just enough to get Trump's beak wet. Because, as has been made abundantly clear, the GOP is Trump, and Trump is the GOP. He's got his daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, in place at the top of the Republican National Committee's pecking order, and she didn't hold back detailing the committee's singular focus. Her quote, "Every single penny will go to the number one and the only job of the RNC. That is electing Donald J. Trump as President of the United States and saving this country." End quote. Sorry, other Republican candidates. Maybe you can find a different Republican National Committee to help you out. Oh, and in the meantime, if you mention the Republican at the top of the ticket, you need to ship some of the green you raise back upstream to the guy already vacuuming donor money up like a Statue of Liberty-sized dirt devil. If this sounds unbecoming of a presidential candidate who claims to be wildly successful and incredibly wealthy, wait until you see the tacky sneakers and weird Bibles he's selling. Adding to the cash thirst, the former president's campaign is trailing President Joe Biden badly in the fundraising department. A Financial Times analysis released this week found Donald Trump has raised $75 million less for his presidential bid than Joe Biden and has 270,000 fewer unique donors now than at the same stage of his run for the White House 4 years ago. Rex continues on, he'd have to sell a moon-high stack of Bibles to catch up, so the grift must grow, and grow it has with his new pony up some cash push on fellow election candidates. As if actively trying to get Trump's campaign cast in the next Martin Scorsese gangster film, the letter to down-ballot Republicans included this line. Here's the quote. Any split that is higher than 5% will be seen favorably by the RNC and President Trump campaign and is routinely reported to the highest levels of leadership within both organizations. end quote. Sure, 5% is nice. That's fine. But you know, maybe do 10%, maybe even 15%. That's the kind of thing that gets you noticed, kid. The letter also included this note to any campaigns that use Trump's name, image, or likeness, and don't play ball. It says, any vendor whose clients ignore the guidelines mentioned above will be held responsible for their clients' actions. Repeated violations will result in the suspension of business relationships between the vendor and Trump National Committee JFC, end quote. Yeah, nice little campaign you got there. Shame if anything happened to it, you know? This all sounds dodgy as the day is long. But regardless, here's what all the little Republican candidates not named Donald Trump are going to do. They're going to line up in their fancy Trump sneakers with their Trump Bibles tucked under their arms and drop an offering in the MAGA hat at the feet of the Donald. Frankly, it's what they deserve. They gambled on this guy again, and the House always wins. Again, that is an opinion from Rex Hupke, who is a columnist for USA Today.
Thank you, Dale. Going to sports now, and the headline on the front page, one of them in, this one says, Valley's Dorenkamp built herself into a star. It's written by Tommy Birch of the Des Moines Register. Addison Dorenkamp had something important to do before boarding an early morning flight to Whitefish, Montana for spring break last year. Dorenkamp, a distance runner at Valley High School in West Des Moines, was so determined to get in a workout that day that she set her alarm for 4 a.m., ventured to a nearly empty gym nearby, and hopped on a treadmill. There were a few guys lifting, Dorenkamp said, but I was definitely the only one cranking out 10 miles on the treadmill. It was nothing new for the hard-working Dorenkamp, whose running career is full of these tales. That work ethic is a big reason why the Valley senior is the most accomplished distance runner in the state. It's also why Dorenkamp, who will run at Alabama next season, was a heavily sought-after recruit by college track and cross-country coaches throughout the nation. She has a gift, said Dorenkamp's mom, Jan, and she's so disciplined. That gift will be on full display this week when Dorenkamp runs at the Drake Relays. The iconic event on the Blue Oval usually ends with a high school athlete becoming the star of the show after some impressive performances. The 17-year-old Dorenkamp, already a state champion in cross country and track, could be that athlete this year. What she has done over the course of her career and the times that she has put out there, she would be a legitimate candidate to be someone to be talked about for the next several years, said Valley girls track coach Keith Bornes. Dorenkamp grew up in the family of runners, but she originally didn't want anything to do with the sport. Her parents, Jan and Steve, were from small-town high school teams in Iowa that didn't even have their own tracks. Steve helped Cal of Latimer to a state title in 1987 and became a frequent attendee of the Drake Relays over the years. He was the one who encouraged Addison to sign up for the Stillwell Junior High School team in seventh grade. At that time, Addison was more interested in soccer. It was kind of a last-minute thing. Let's try it, Addison said. It would keep me in shape for soccer. Neither Addison nor her parents had big expectations, at least not early on. In fact, she surprised everyone during her first competition in the two-mile run. The race featured tons of competitors in 7th and 8th grades, but she stood out. Jan, who, driving back from a work trip in Waterloo, was surprised when she got phone calls from Steve and a neighbor of theirs. They were raving about Addison as they explained how she finished in the top 15. Jan couldn't believe it. I'm like, well, how many races are there? Jan recalled. It shocked everyone, including Addison. But the success quickly fueled a love of running. There was more to come. Addison's team could run only in that event and the state meet that year. So as the season went on, Jan tracked the times of other runners so she were to see where her daughter's time stacked up. She was among the best. Addison proved it wasn't a fluke later in the year when she helped her seventh grade team to a state title. "That was kind of when I was like, oh, I'm kind of good at this," Addison said. Addison wanted to be even better, so she devoted all her energy toward running. She quit soccer and focused on her new sport. When Addison got to high school, she started showing up to voluntary cross-country workouts at Valley 7 days a week at 7:30 a.m. During her sophomore year, she started lifting weights as many as 3 days a week. Addison began a strict diet regime. She managed it herself by doing her own grocery shopping and prepping her own meals. Her running routine would be just as intense. Bornes said her post-practice school cool-down sometimes consists of runs as far as 8 miles. Wow. The Dornkamps planned spring break trips around her passion for the sport so she could find places to run. The devotion to be great was endless. "Her discipline is crazy," Jan said. "The hard work has paid off." After winning the state in cross-country in 2021, she entered the 2022 season as the favorite. But Dornkamp, who dealt with an inflamed quad and glute, missed most of the season. Dornkamp's first race came less than 20 days before the state meet, and she couldn't even finish it. As runners passed her, she heard an opposing coach talk about how another runner was able to break her. Dornkamp was determined to prove them wrong, so she showed up to Ben Tillis' business, XLR8 Performance Lab in Ankeny, and worked for up to 4 hours a day to get ready for the state meet. The two plotted a plan to get her healthy for the meet, which was at the same location as her first race. They even came up with an idea for her to take control of the race at the very spot she went down at. It worked to perfection. Dornkamp not only won a state title, but tallied the fourth best time in state history. "No one in the state could match her work ethic," Tillis said. The success attracted the attention of college coaches throughout the nation. Just a week after teams could start reaching her, Dornkamp got her first phone call. And then another, and another. Jan says she's heard from at least one school in every major conference. Addison wanted to live somewhere warm and run in the Southeastern Conference. She loves the coaches at Alabama and their plans for developing her into an even better runner. Dornkamp felt at home on the campus and was in awe of the team's facilities. So she signed with Alabama in November. "It was very special and it just felt like home," Dornkamp said. "The second I got down there, I knew that's where I wanted to go." The success, including back-to-back state titles in the 1500 and 3000 in 2022 and 23, and the signing with prestigious program have made Dornkamp the star of the track and field season. All eyes will be on her during this week's Drake Relays. The event always features the best runners in the state. Dornkamp watches runners such as Peyton Noe of Ballard and Ali Franson garnered awards, accolades, and attention in recent relays. This year, it could be Dornkamp's time to shine as she sets her sights on the breaking records in the 1500 and 3000. She's also run in the 4x800. "Not many people have been able to do what she did," Bornes said. With the end of her high school career coming to a close, Addison has a chance to go down in history as one of the Drake Relay's biggest names. She's ready for it. "The opportunity to potentially be that athlete is definitely something really special because it's my last year at the Drake Relays as a high schooler," she said. "So I'm just excited to see what happens."
Before we get to Dear Abby, I'll let you know what you can watch on television regarding sports. In the NHL, at 6 p.m. tonight on ESPN, you can catch Washington at New York Rangers. At 6:30 p.m. on ESPN2, Tampa Bay is at Florida. 8:30 p.m. on ESPN is Colorado at Winnipeg. And finally, at 9 p.m. on ESPN2 is Nashville at Vancouver. Those were NHL games. In basketball, there are some NBA games on tonight at 6:30 p.m. on TNT. You can catch Phoenix at Minnesota. 7:30 p.m. on the NBA T Network is Indiana at Milwaukee. And at 9 p.m. on TNT, Dallas at the L.A. Clippers. There are a few Major League Baseball games on tonight as well, if you're interested in those. At 6:40 p.m. on TBS, Houston will play at Chicago. At 9:38 p.m. on ESPN and MLBN networks will be Baltimore at the Los Angeles Angels. At 8:45 p.m. on the MLBN network is the New York Mets at San Francisco for Major League Baseball. And finally, in soccer, there is an English Premier League game at 2 p.m. today on the USA NBCU network, and that will be Chelsea at Arsenal. Let's see. I'll just read you a headline here before I move on. In college women's basketball, Iowa State has gotten a commitment from TCU transfer Harris. That would be Texas Christian's Sydney Harris, who will be playing for Iowa State next season. All right, I guess it's time for Dear Abby. The headline for Dear Abby is "The Truth Comes Out Via Conveniently Timed Text. There are two letters today. The first one says, "Dear Abby, a few years ago, my sister and I took our kids on vacation together. She and I get along, but have never been close. Sometimes I walk on eggshells around her because I never know what might make her upset. I thought we were having a good time on that vacation and getting along well, even though I was anxious. We were both taking pictures with our phones, and she handed me hers to forward myself some of the pictures. While I was looking at them, a text message pinged, and I checked it without thinking about it not being my phone. It turns out my sister had spent the entire vacation texting about my, quote, BS, my inability to do anything competently, and even referenced something that happened years before. I had noticed her constant texting, but said nothing because I didn't want to risk an argument. I am still angry about this, and I don't know how to let it go. I really don't want to travel with her again, since I know the invisible third party will be with us the whole time. How do I deal with this? Signed, Staying Put in New Jersey. Abby says, Dear Staying Put, when you saw that message from your sister's text partner, you should have handed her the phone and started packing. You are not obligated to travel with someone who causes you to walk on eggshells, ignores you, puts you down, and says nasty things behind your back. Don't be mean about taking steps to protect yourself. Simply stop vacationing with her. I know I sure would. A second letter says, Dear Abby, my wife recently had her DNA tested so she could learn more about her genealogy. She then decided to make her results public so other possible relatives could contact her. Not long ago, she received an email from a man named Stan claiming a DNA match. Stan said he was adopted, and his search to find his birth parents had hit a dead end. My wife immediately recalled old family stories about an older relative who is still alive, who had given up her baby for adoption. Several pieces of information from Stan matched, like his birthplace, and we have no doubt my wife's relative is this man's parent. Our question, do we help Stan contact his long-lost parent? As sad as it may be, I don't think it's our business to surprise my wife's kin with news of a son they've never talked about. My wife is leaning in the opposite direction and sees no harm. What do we do? Signed, To Help or Not to Help. Abby says, Dear To Help, your wife should contact the relative in question, explain about her DNA test, and inform her she has been contacted by a man claiming he is related. She should tell her relative she had long ago heard about a child that may have been placed for adoption. If your wife's relative would like to have Stan's contact information, she should share it. However, if this relative isn't open to being contacted, your wife should let the matter rest. All right, let's do a little weather recap. If I can find the weather. Oh, there it is. In Des Moines today, the high is expected to be 70, the low tonight down to 40. It will become increasingly windy today, back to more of that, with clouds and sun. The winds will be from 12 to 25 miles per hour. Tonight should be clear and moonlit. The temperature, normal high of 70, is pretty close to normal. Normal high is 64, normal low is 43. And sunrise today was at 6:22. Sunset tonight will be at 8:04. And I think it's a full moon today, too. So look for that tonight. That brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today, Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024. I'm Dale Finnegan, and my partner at the microphone has been Doug Kretzinger. Earlier, you heard Deanna Snyder and Pat Steele. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at our website, iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings come from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.